Thank you, Louise. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's call, we have Ron Androff, Avery Doria, Ray Fassett, Wolf Ulrich Knoben. From staff, we have Julie Headland, Ken Bauer, Rob Hogarth, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We do have apologies from Tony Holmes. And if I could please just remind everyone to state their names. Thank you. Over to you, Ray.
Great. Thank you. Ray Fassett here. First bit of housekeeping. I would like to say that Avery has formally joined the work team. So if we could update that on the wiki page, et cetera, that would be good. Representing which stakeholder group, Avery? Avery, you there? Okay. Well.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll update the wiki.
Yeah, update the wiki. Okay. All right. So that's that housekeeping. Quick summary. I think we had a productive session in Seoul. As we know, the operating procedures were approved by council, so that was good progress made. Now, one thing that did occur that I think we're all aware of is that there was a document management issue that occurred from the time the work team submitted its final, if you will, edits to the document that kind of got reformatted. Not the same document that was reformatted, it happened to be the last version that we completed. And unfortunately, it was the incorrect document that went to public comment, et cetera, and that became the document that was approved by the council, the procedures. So, and this was recognized in Seoul and understood in Seoul, and the remedy on this was going to be to double back right after the Seoul meeting and submit back to council the fresh document with the edits. So this required a bit of work, you know, doubling back to getting that document that we completed reformatted into a, you know, a user-friendly format. Required a lot of work, you know, to do that. And so they had to double back and get the correct version from us. When I say they, I mean I can't staff. Rob Hogarth, with the assistance of Julie, at our request, to do that. So they've done that now. And this version with the edits will now be going to council for their consideration and approval. Is there any questions on this part? I have forwarded now. I've gotten the document from Rob. I have forwarded that document to the list. I haven't seen it pop through for me yet. I just did it maybe 10 minutes ago. But these are edits that we've already discussed and looked at. Are there any questions on this, though, procedurally?
Ray, this is Rob. I'd just like to acknowledge Ken Bauer's tremendous work on helping pull that together.
He gets
the labor credit for that.
great. Thank you, Ken. Yeah, obviously, when people ask the question on, you know, I can't staff support, is it important? I think we can attest it is, because this was a pretty big project for them to have to double back to. It was just an honest error that could happen to anybody in the document management process, and then double back and catch these edits again. I have looked at it myself, and they did a really nice job. They caught them. They got them. And it was a lot of work, so thank you for doing that. Now, procedurally, is there any questions on what is going on here now with the rules of procedure? If not, I think we could move on to some more substantive issues yet in front of us.
Ray, this is Ken Bauer. Just a quick one. You're aware that that Chuck Gomes has yet made another couple of minor changes to that document, and that's the one that is that the one you're working from?
Yeah, actually, that's the one I did see today. That's exactly what I actually zeroed in on. Okay, what did Chuck do? All right, we don't need any edits here, right? You know, we just want to. So I quickly looked. I only saw one. I don't even recall what it was. And it really was nothing. Was there another one? There was nothing substantive that I saw.
No, I agree with that. I caught several. Like in 2.2, it said in the case of a tie, and he put in for the most votes between two candidates, things like that.
Yeah.
He added the word council before vice chair, which just is clarification. And I think that was really... I didn't catch much else either.
Yeah, it's really, I don't think there's anything substantive. First of all, I don't think Chuck would go there, just from working with him on other things and experience. But even with that, my look at it, I just didn't see anything substantive that really, I don't think our work team really needs to dwell on.
Right. In there was one more. In 2.2 IV of 4, Roman numeral 4, it originally said, in the event that, and he took that out and just said, in case neither candidate. So, again, that's just sort of English.
Okay, so those are some examples, maybe all the examples that Chuck had. Does anybody have any comments on whether we need to go in and review Chuck's comments or edits that he made now to this latest version? Anybody have any concerns?
No concerns on my side. It's Ron.
Okay.
Hello.
Okay, very good. So,
Wolf speaking here. Did you send the last version already?
Yeah,
I didn't see that.
I did. I haven't gotten it. Julie, do you want to go ahead and send it out?
Yeah, let me send it. I don't know if maybe your access to the list is having problems, but let me send it to everyone right now.
Okay, so if you get it from me and Julie, you'll know it's the same thing.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. And this ties into something that Wolf emailed earlier. There's an item 3, a motion. Wolf, can you explain what that motion is real quick so we understand exactly what the whole picture here? What is that motion?
I understand this motion refers to the small amendments Chuck did. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a motion. It should be a motion to accept these small edits. That's it.
Right, a motion to the council?
Yes. So I think just formally, what Chuck is going to do is, for the next council meeting, is to tell the councillors, okay, that's what he would like to get amended, so, and he would like to offer formal amendment through a motion.
Okay, so that just kind of gives the full circle here of what's going on. So if you see something in there about how the council approved a new rules of procedure, I don't want anybody on the work team thinking, well, wait a minute, what was that all about? So we all know what's going on and why, right? Okay, that's important. Okay, so anything else in that email, Wolf, that you wanted to go over?
No. That was, you know, just to keep you informed about that. So
great.
That's it.
Great. Okay, so we can maybe move on to a substantive issue that came out of the Seoul meeting. The biggest feedback I think we got on these rules of procedure, again, was the issue of how should abstentions be handled in the voting process, right? And the reason I asked Ken to stay on is because he did some research on this. We talked about it in Seoul. There are different options. Ken went out and looked at how do other associations or how do other industries handle this question. And Ken, why don't you go ahead and just give the group a brief summary of what you kind of found impartially there.
I will be happy to give it a try. I was scrolling through my document to see if I could come up with a crisp way to do that. I'm not sure if everybody have a copy of that paper. It was posted on the public comment forum related to the council operating procedures. I'm not sure if it's been circulated to your team separately.
It hasn't, Ken.
Okay. All right. So that helps me to know how to approach this a little bit.
Yeah.
In essence, what I did in the paper is I did spend some time on the internet researching the subject of abstentions, which, by the way, also dovetails very closely with conflicts of interest, and I'll try to explain that connection in a minute, and also what people do with calculations when abstentions occur. And that turns out, I think, to be the sort of fundamental question here is, if someone abstains in the old GNSO policy, or the current operating rules, or that were there before Seoul, the denominators in making determinations about majorities or two-thirds or 75, whatever the calculations are, the denominators never change. So what you end up having then is somebody who is ready to vote says, I abstain, but that abstention, in effect, gets treated like a no in the sense that the way that all the voting procedures were written and are now written, it requires a certain amount of yes votes to pass any motion. And so anything that isn't a yes is effectively a no, right? And so the question that I was researching was, when in other organizations, government and others, when people abstain, do they change the denominators as well as the numerator in trying to figure out whether you have a majority? So to use a simple example, I've got five people on a committee, and we're going to take a vote. I need three in a majority to pass a motion, and one person abstains, right? Now, if that person abstains, do I still need three yes votes, or because that abstention occurs, do I change the denominator from five to four? Now, in that case, I did a bad math example because it still requires three, right? Two is not a majority, but you get the idea, right?
Yeah.
In some instances, if you change the denominator, it takes one less vote or two less votes, depending on how many abstentions there are, in order to pass the measure. Okay, so what did I find? A mixed bag, of course. There's very few things in life that are commonly done by everybody. But what I found is that, generally speaking, abstentions are done for sort of two basic reasons. We're going to call them voluntary reasons and involuntary reasons. If I abstain from a vote because, for example, I'm not familiar with the issue, I haven't read up on it, or maybe I have some kind of personal reason for just not wanting to vote, that's called a voluntary abstention. And in almost all cases I looked at, no change is made to the denominator when people voluntarily abstain. In essence, it's treated like they just weren't there, right? If you just didn't attend the meeting, well, that, you know, your vote doesn't count, but we don't change any of the calculations as a result of that. The second case we'll call involuntary abstentions. Many organizations make a very significant difference between where situations exist where they don't want people voting. I mean, they actually say, look, if you are in this situation, you must not vote. And in addition to not voting, you must not participate in the discussions, et cetera, because to do so is a serious sort of conflict of interest. And that's where this tie-in comes in, as I mentioned earlier. So in cases where people have, we'll call them material conflicts of interest, to differentiate from ones that, and when I say the word material, I mean that, the organization at large would say, looking at this particular person's situation, that the conflict of interest is serious and would affect the whole organization's operations if that person were to take part. I could myself individually think I have a conflict of interest, right? And I could say, look, I'm going to abstain because I have a conflict of interest, but if I described it, everybody else in the organization would say, well, wait a minute, that's not material. And so we're not going to give you a conflict of interest label for that abstention. That's going to be a voluntary one. So that's why I use the word material here to differentiate from those that are generally regarded as serious. Okay. In the case of a material conflict of interest, then, almost every organization I looked at changes the denominator. I couldn't find any examples of cases where somebody said, I have a material conflict of interest and I'm abstaining for that reason. It's involuntary on my part, meaning that if anybody else looked at the situation, they would say, yep, you absolutely cannot vote here. And generally, those material conflicts of interest relate to things like, I'm taking money from somebody that's involved in the decision. I have a consulting relationship. I have some kind of financial interest in the outcome of the decision, and as a result, I am materially conflicted here. And in those cases, we would change the denominator. Okay, so that's the paper then, after going through some of this early digestive material, what I did was I actually created a set of potential changes to the operating procedures under a heading that goes a way forward, potential additions and modifications to the new GNSO procedures. It starts with something called the duty of counselors, which basically says here everybody's got a duty to stay involved with the issues, keep track of what's going on, and participate in voting wherever possible. However, recognizing that sometimes that doesn't always happen, we provide a paragraph called voluntary abstentions, and there are some examples that illustrate what those things could be. For example, not being adequately informed or having been in the discussions, having some religious or other kind of non-material conflict. Those are all examples that would potentially allow someone to abstain, but it would not change the denominators. And then we create a category called material conflicts of interest, give some examples of what would give rise to that. For example, this economic interest idea and other assorted issues that there are actually not too many of those. And then we talk about some scenarios when material conflicts of interest could arise and sort of what to do about them, right? Because it's also possible, especially in the GNSO, where if I'm a representative of the, let's just say, the intellectual property constituency, and I say I have a material conflict of interest, I could go back to my constituency and I could say, hey, guys, I am conflicted here, but I am supposed to vote. So why don't you tell me how I should vote in this situation, absolving me of my conflict, and you give me the answer I'm supposed to go. I'm representing you in this case. I am not voting my own conscience. And that would be like for an example of a way to resolve a material conflict of interest, which would still allow a member to vote and would not require a change in the denominator.
All right, so let me just stop you there. Everything's making sense, and I just want to interrupt. Now, there are some stakeholder groups that require in their charters that their council reps represent the views of their constituency. And then there are other stakeholder groups that don't have that requirement. I believe the business constituency, for example, does not require their reps to necessarily at all times be representing the views of that stakeholder group. Where I can say in the registry stakeholder group, it is a requirement for our reps to be representing the views of the group.
I can interject there, Ray. It's Ron with BC.
Yeah.
We have in the new charter, the representatives have to vote along the lines of as directed by the constituency.
Okay.
This is Ken again. I could tell you that I was fortunate to attend the Internet Service Providers meeting in Seoul, and that subject also came up, and they're modifying their charter, I believe, to make that clear also.
So in theory, when we're talking about conflicts, we're talking about conflict as it relates to the ability of the rep to represent the views of their stakeholder group, not a conflict as it pertains to the issue at hand being somehow advantageous to the individual's rep's interests.
There is an example that was pointed out to me, I think it was by Christina Rosette and seconded by Steve Metallitz, where in their situation, as lawyers, they also are obligated to follow their legal ethical code of conduct. And if she was saying something like, if I have a conflict of interest that my profession would say is a conflict, you can't resolve it. The conflict is there. And we didn't have time at Seoul to really follow through on that, because I think I would have said, well, what about if you go back to your constituency and say, tell me how to vote, would that be okay? And we just didn't get through that discussion.
Yeah, so that's really, to me, I think a question others can chime in, but I think it is. I mean, where is the conflict of interest? Is it between you and your constituency? Or let's call them stakeholder groups. Is it between you and the group you're representing? Or what? We need to understand, I think, as a work team, we understand that there's conflicts of interest. We understand that, the question of how it should impact the denominator or not. What we don't understand is where is the conflict? Is the conflict between your ability to represent your group's interests? Because if that's a conflict, then you maybe should not be a rep, So, I mean, that's kind of off the top, but that's kind of what it drives. So I don't know if the conflict of interest that we're talking about, as it affects voting, has to do with the issue at hand, or if it has to do with the rep's ability to represent their group's interests. And if their group charters, stakeholder group charters, are requiring them across the board, which we don't know, we got to get that answer, to represent their group interests, that's something we need to know, versus maybe some stakeholder groups that don't have that requirement, which changes the question for us. So any thoughts on this?
Well, it's Ron. I have a real problem with the fact that it wasn't in our previous charter, and that one of our representatives actually made that comment that he had the right to make whatever decisions he wanted unilaterally.
In Seoul, right? Somebody said
right,
that.
That's right.
I heard that too. Yeah.
And so we were really upset about that. But parking that for a moment, I think that it should be incumbent upon all the constituencies, and maybe we should be considering we've got enough staff members on this call, and that you are looking at the charters. We should be enforcing that the representatives who are sitting at council level are speaking on behalf of the constituency, because the only ones who do not speak on behalf of a constituency are the non-com reps. So there's a very clear distinction there, and that's important that we get that right.
Ron, this is Ken Bauer. Most of the charters do have such language, and after this next set of rewrites, I think they probably all will. But even the ones that have the language, and I'm not sure how you guys dealt with this in yours yet, but they'll say something like, in the event that the constituency or the stakeholder group does not have a position formally on some motion, then the councillor is allowed to vote their conscience. And I suppose that in that case, if the person said, oh, I have a conflict of interest, and I don't have a position for my constituency, we might have one of these cases. It's going to be extremely rare, I would think, but it could happen.
I don't see the reason. I'm sorry, is someone else trying to speak?
Yeah, this is Aubrey. I'd like to get in the queue to make a comment, if that's all.
Okay, Ron, then Aubrey.
I wanted to just say that I don't see that there should ever be a situation where the representative votes their conscience. It should be either they're voting on behalf of their constituency or they're abstaining, because the person sitting at that chair at that table is not an individual. They are representatives of that organization. So this is what I'm trying to drive at, is I think that we need to tighten up these elements, that there should not be someone voting their conscience other than the non-coms, because that's specifically why the non-coms have been invited. Maybe Avery can share some more light on that.
Avery, go ahead.
Okay. Actually, I was going to talk from the basis of the NCSG, and the situation becomes slightly more complicated there. They do not have a history in NCUC, or I believe an intention in NCSG, of enforcing party discipline on any vote. It's a very diverse group where there'll be many different points of view expressed within the stakeholder group on many of the different issues. You know, it really does advertise itself as sort of a big tent in terms of viewpoints, positions, and whatever. So it's not that the council members will be voting their own conscience, as it were, but they are representatives. If they don't vote in a way that represents at least some segment of the NCSG, they'll end up getting voted out. So it's really a representational democracy point of view, is we elect someone we trust to go in there and do what, you know, is reasonable within the constituency we're at. But there's rarely a case where party discipline of everyone must vote this way is going to be called. It's just not what they do. It's a representational system.
Oh, actually, I just want to be clear on that. That's a good point. But even in the registry constituency, it's a representational system too. What happens is that our council reps come back to the constituency, explain what's coming up for a vote, allow for a discussion on that, and then gather the consensus of the group, and then goes back to the council and votes accordingly. So it's representational too, even though it may state in the stakeholder group charter that the rep is to represent the interests of the group. So it's just a matter of how you go about it. I think what you're saying, Aubrey, is the system in the non-commercial stakeholder group is perhaps not as formal, in that before a rep can go in and actually perform a vote, there's not a formal process where that vote, the what is being voted on, is not discussed in the stakeholder group. Is that correct?
It is discussed. There's an open discussion on, you know, here's what we're going to be voting on, and then there'll be a discussion on it, and then the council member will take that and go vote. There's not perhaps a formal process of, therefore, we decide that the NCSG believes, you know, 50% of them believe this and 20% of them believe that, so let's assign the vote.
Right.
There is a certain take it to the group, have discussions, get feedback, and then based on that feedback, decide on your vote. And if your vote is inconsistent, then it doesn't pass the sniff test, and then you'll get yelled at, and then maybe you'll get replaced. But
okay, so it's just really the same thing. So the rep that goes, the not NC stakeholder group rep that goes and does the vote is representing what the discussion was about. So it would be at that point of discussion that if the group felt that, you know, the vote a certain way, it would be at that point the rep would say to the group, well, I'm sorry, I can't vote that way. I have a conflict. That is where that would come out, wouldn't
it? Okay. Yeah, I guess so. Now, I have one question with the conflict, because one of the things that was brought out in the discussion was that if you have a conflict like that, not only do you abstain from voting, but you abstain from discussing the topic at any point in any of the discussions. And so would there be an assumption that one would not be qualified for abstaining if they had ever spoken to the topic?
Well, okay, so let's say something is being voted on at the council level. The stakeholder group rep is going back to their council representatives for discussion on what the subject matter is. Immediately right there, the rep would have to say, I cannot discuss this with my own with my own group. I can't discuss this with you because I have a conflict of interest. That's where that would happen. Does that make sense? In other words, the conflict isn't at the council level. The conflict is at the stakeholder group level.
Yes, yes. So it's Wolf speaking. So that's the point, I think, that's what I see. Because we had also this discussion in Seoul in our constituency about that, and it was very clear that we will have, before every council meeting, we shall have a call for an ISPDP call and talking about discussing all the potential motions as well, and then fix our votes, let me say, situation, position on that. So that's how we are going to deal with. And that makes it that the conflict shall be on constituency or stakeholder group level. That's what I think it sounds.
Yeah, and in thinking this out loud, I'm having difficulty rationalizing, if there's a conflict at the stakeholder group level, why the denominator needs to change. I would call that a voluntary conflict, not an involuntary conflict.
Yes, Ray, so that's Wolf speaking again. That brings me to the basic point as well. So for me, I could accept, you know, if we find really a clear definition of what is material conflict of interest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But because, so what I would like to avoid is that somebody comes up and says, oh, hey, I have a conflict of interest, and okay, then it's just trusting, okay, that there's a kind of it. But there is no material behind that, or maybe not material. So the question is, what kind of material is behind of that conflict? And I understood Ken before as well that he was saying, okay, that there may be a discussion then on the council, whether to accept it as material or not.
Right. So the question is something like this, I think, if I'm understanding it. It would be a council rep states to other council members, I have a conflict with my stakeholder group. I'm going to need to abstain on this vote. And then the question to us is that a material conflict or an immaterial conflict? At the council level now, is it a material conflict or an immaterial conflict?
So Wolf speaking again. So I'm not sure that whether we should have on council level such kind of discussion, because that's a never-ending story.
Well, no, I mean, for our work team, I'm just throwing out the question. The conflict does not sit at the council level, if we agree on that. The conflict sits at the stakeholder group level. The question to our work team is, when the rep has to say, I have a conflict because my stakeholder group wants me to vote a certain way, that is I have a conflict with. Should that be a material conflict as it pertains to how to count abstentions as part of the vote, or should that be an immaterial conflict as how you count abstentions as part of a vote?
Ray, this is Ken Bauer. I understand the question you're asking. It might be helpful to have some examples to deal with. It's hard for me just to think about that and understand it as being material if it exists between the counselor and his or her constituency or stakeholder group. But even if we don't deal with that question, let's assume it could be material, right? Let's just assume that for a moment. There's still other ways to resolve it without having to change the denominator.
Okay.
For example, maybe we could introduce something in the way of a proxy voting, where if I'm one of n number of counselors from a stakeholder group and I have a conflict with my stakeholder group about some particular issue, maybe my vote proxies over to the other counselor and the constituent says, you're voting now for yourself and for this other person who's conflicted on this vote.
Well, Ken, that's a little bit complicated, I would say, so because I understand that proxy voting is only feasible on council level. That means the proxy must be a councillor, isn't it? From another stakeholder group, maybe.
It could be one of the NCAs that's asked to proxy that vote, right?
Sure.
Every stakeholder group has one, so.
Yeah, sure, but okay, that is. I wouldn't say that's feasible. So from my point of view, so just in case, if I have a personal conflict of interest, which is not accepted as being material, then I go for proxy voting. Is that what you're saying?
No, only if it was material. If it's immaterial, then it would be voluntary. And the way at least I've drafted these tentative procedures, there would be no change in the denominator.
So what I was saying
to Ray is you could allow for the possibility of a material conflict of interest even between the counselor and his or her organization, representative organization, whether it's a stakeholder group or constituency, and still have a provision that allows for a resolution to that conflict that doesn't change the denominator. That's all.
And that would be by awarding your vote to another rep.
Yes.
Yeah. In your own constituent, stakeholder group. Yeah.
Correct.
For me, it's not that clear. So what I would like to have is really a clear clear position and a clear rule about it.
I'd like to understand, too, how can a conflict of interest happen at the council level? I understand how it can happen at the stakeholder group level. And I'm not clear how a conflict of interest can even happen at the council level. If you're just there representing the views of your stakeholder group, where could there even be a conflict?
Well, Ray, if it's a that someone's there representing the views of the registry constituency, but there's and the view of the constituency has something to do with the idea of new top-level domains, and the representative is speaking is an applicant for a new TLD, there is a conflict in so much as he or she is an applicant, and while they're voting the vote of the registry that may fall in the favor of that applicant, there's still that conflict. So the whole, I think what Ken's saying is if there's any sense that there might be a conflict at that point, then you would just step back, you know, to recuse yourself from that. That, that individual would recuse themselves and say, I'll pass that off, that yeah. vote off to someone else to make that call.
Well, let me counter that example, if you don't mind, okay?
Please.
So,
so
this rep is a potential applicant of a new TLD. He would disclose that. He or she would have to disclose. He's the, they're the rep for their group. They would have to, a vote is coming up, a discussion is coming up, I want to disclose to my own stakeholder group, because that's my responsibility, that we are going to be an applicant. Does anybody mind that I'm going to vote on this in the group, in my in the stakeholder group? So the registry's group says, no, we understand. Yeah, we that you may be doing that in a private matter, in a private business initiative. Whatever it is you're doing, we trust that you're still going to represent what we're asking you to how to represent us. So that, again, it's at the stakeholder group level.
That's all, but that's fair enough there. But the issue may arise that someone sitting in another stakeholder group may say, "I didn't see anything in their declaration of interest or their statement of interest. You know, I'm not happy with what's happening here." So it's because they may not have been privy to that conversation internally within that constituency or that that stakeholder group. They may be lacking that information, and then they may bring forward the idea that, hey, this person's not declaring themselves, what's going on? So I'm saying it's just this perception that we've got to avoid, the issues of, you know, false perception.
Well, there's always going to be that. There's always going to be, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but there's always going to be false perception. How you actually combat that is through education. So the answer to that would be, I represent the interests of my group. I am acting in my group. At end of story. There's no conflict here.
So, I'm not going to push back. I'm not going to push back.
Yeah,
on that,
yeah. So anyway, I got off tangent. So, is there any other
this
comments?
Is Aubrey.
Yeah, Aubrey, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Aubrey on that one. I guess it's there's proof of it, and then there's the visibility, and being able to determine what degree someone really is objective. You can say that I am here just representing my stakeholder group, and the fact that my employer, you know, won't fire me for taking this vote is clear. But when you do a clear personal involvement in something, I believe you could end up with something that at least has the appearance of conflict of interest and such. So I'm not sure possible to unequivocally say that because you're doing what your stakeholder group tells you to do, you therefore do not have a possibility of conflict.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the possibility. I think about elected representatives. How could it not be possible that at some points, but they're representing their constituents, the people that voted them in.
Well, I think, Ray, if I might just jump in on this. I mean, we did a lot of work on the Statement of Interest and Declaration of Interest documentation.
Correct.
I think so, you know, if we step back from this kind of the minutiae that we're getting into in this debate and look at kind of the holistic approach that we've taken, I think that, you know, what we've asked is the chair will ask before any vote is taken or any meeting begins or discussion, you know, are there any changes in the statements of interest or declarations of interest? Mm-hmm. At that point, if someone were to have a conflict and be concerned that it might be, you know, appear not to be in good order, they can make a statement to clarify it. Point being is that I think we've got safeguards in place. It really comes to the bigger issue of when, you know, coming back to that abstention issue, what is an abstention and what is it count? How does it count as a vote or not a vote? You know, that's more the critical issue here. I think the issue of getting around our declarations of interest and statements of interest, I don't think anybody's going to try to avoid those. So I think we might, you know, be talking about something that's not so critical at this stage as opposed to the abstention issue.
Right. Sorry, if I can add something. I think you might be right. I think that even the one that I was thinking of, that I feel there might be an appearance of conflict here, does become voluntary. and as such is not an imposed. So I think you're right. Bringing it up to the top level, it remains a voluntary abstention because it'll look like you're doing the wrong thing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That's very well said by Ron and Aubrey. So where are we at? Can somebody summarize where we're at?
Well, I would ask the question, maybe, and I think Ken might be able to do it, but the question then comes back to, so where do we stand with regard to that individual voting or not voting vis-a-vis the abstention? And how can we get around this? If I understood at the top of the conversation, Ken, you said something, and I may have misunderstood it, that you had trouble finding others that decreased the denominator or kept the denominator. I wasn't quite sure what you said there.
Yeah, in cases where there is, to use the same language, this involuntary or material conflict of interest, an involuntary abstention, where, you, to use the representative example, I'm representing, you know, my community, and I am on the a board of counselors, a board of supervisors, right? And it turns out that we're going to approve a contract for a big real estate development, and my brother owns the company, right? So I have a material conflict of interest in voting for that contract when my brother owns the company who's bidding on that job. So now it's going to be hard for me to come up with an example like that for the GNSO Council, but in the case of an involuntary abstention where there is a material conflict of interest, every organization I looked at changes the denominator. The vote comes out, the denominator changes, and if it takes a majority of X, it now takes a majority, of X minus one to make that happen.
Yeah. So where I'm at on this is I need to understand what would count, what would be considered as an involuntary abstention at the council level.
Yes.
I'm not clear of what one would be.
This is Ken again, and I don't have a really good example for you because Rob and I talked about this for a while, and we couldn't come up with anything either. But one way to deal with it. Because the intellectual property folks that I talked to, and I mentioned their names earlier, Christina and Steve, they felt very, very sure that there would be situations where there would be material conflicts of interest, and they would have to recuse themselves.
That's what we need to find out.
Okay, fine.
We need that information, and we need to understand why does that conflict exist at the council level and not at the stakeholder group level.
Yeah.
What is the difference there? I understand they've got them in their head. We need to understand. Are they, are they looking, have they segregated this correctly? They may not have thought about this question. They may not have looked at it the way we're looking at it, which is where is this conflict? Is it at your stakeholder group level or is it at the council level? Give me examples so we can understand.
Right.
So how can we go about that? Okay, who's that, Wolf?
Yes.
Wolf, yeah, please. Go ahead, Wolf.
I understand from our discussion that we may agree to such a process, let me say. That we could accept the cases where real material conflict of interest arise. So if that is the case, okay, then we could accept, okay, let's go for abstention and let's decrease the denominator in that. So that's what I understood from the discussion, and I would agree to that as well. So What we cannot find, as you formulated, was, we cannot find real examples right now. But I think we don't expect too many, not a big variety of examples which could come up to the council for such cases. So why shouldn't we suggest, let's just see the frame of what we are looking at. It means we accept the conflict of interest which are materialized, and then let's just start on council level and let's see what happens. So in case somebody comes with a question for abstention, then he has to describe what is the material behind that, and then later on it could be taken on a list to a list which is added to which is added and which may be amended from time to time. And it is added to the rules of procedure. It shouldn't be fixed because we cannot find right now all potential cases, but we don't expect too many.
This is Ken. That Wolf, yeah, I like what you're just saying. And if you guys have a chance to read this paper I put together, I actually had written draft language that might end up in the council operating procedures. I didn't place it in what section, but just to give you an example, Section 5 deals with the procedures when a material conflict of interest is raised. Let me just real quickly summarize that, because there's a Steve Metalis actually read this document thoroughly and sought me out in Seoul and said, "Ken, I've got some problems with your dissertation on this subject." And I've already recounted what a couple of those are, but there's one more, and I haven't dealt with it. Let me just take a minute, if I may, and I'll do this briefly.
Quick interruption.
Yeah.
Is it possible for Julie just to send that document around so we're actually following you? Julie, do you have that document, or Ken, could you send it to the list?
Yeah, I have the this is Julie. I have the document. I hadn't sent it because I was waiting for Ray to say it was okay to send. I'll go ahead.
Oh, yeah, it's okay to send. By the way, this is a public comment. This is in the public comment form.
Sorry to interrupt, but if you could send that around, that would be helpful. Thank you.
I'll do it right now. Thank you. This is Julie.
Yeah, while that's taking place, I'll just go ahead, because I think these points are not too numerous, and I don't think it'll burden you to just sort of hear what I'm saying. So it starts out, a counselor who believes that his or her action, participating/voting, involving a measure before the council would result in a material conflict is required to follow these procedures. And I just laid out a five or six steps here. First, document the circumstances that give rise to the material conflict of interest and provide that statement to the GNSO Secretariat. Second step, seek all reasonable means to eliminate the conflict. And I only give two examples. If representing a stakeholder group or constituency, appeal to that organization's leadership to survey its members and direct how the vote on the conflicting issue shall be entered. Now, it would be important that we talked before about perceptions of conflict, right? Even if there isn't a real conflict, or if there's a perceived one, it sometimes might be helpful for transparency reasons to get the statement from the constituency that says, I know that it looks like this person is conflicted, and everybody on the council knows it, and everybody else looking around knows it, but we're directing the vote, and here's a statement that says that, right? So that would be the purpose behind it. Second, if the person happened to be an NCA who was conflicted, request permission of the council to allow the non-voting NCA to vote on the matter in place of the conflicted council. It's just an idea. The next step, if the conflict cannot be avoided after pursuing reasonable means available, then the counselor may request permission to refrain from voting by entering an abstention, which shall not affect any quorum calculations. However, it would reduce the numerator and denominator in the voting tabulations for the affected house. Now, here's the next key point that might be troublesome. I added this. Because the potential effect of changing the denominator could have on whether actions pass or fail, each abstention for material reasons must be approved by a majority vote of the opposite house in order to be entered by the requesting counselor. Now, again, Steve Metalis did not like that idea very much, meaning if I step forward and say I have a material conflict of interest and I must abstain and that should change the denominator, he did not think it was a good idea that question should be posed to the other house and that they would have the opportunity to make the determination. The reason I liked it is because since gaming can be done when you start moving the denominators around, it gives the other house the opportunity to look at the material conflict of interest and say, render a judgment, which says, you know what, after looking at it, we don't think there really is a material conflict here, and the counselor should not recuse him or herself from this vote. Now, the work team, you might want to tweak that. You could either eliminate it, or you could keep it, or you might say maybe it takes a majority vote of both houses in order to approve the conflict or something like that. Then the last step in this set of procedures was, if an abstention is approved by the other house, that counselor shall not participate in discussions or otherwise attempt to influence other council members, nor shall he or she vote on any action attendant to the matter for which the conflict is present. And that's it. That's that section.
I can understand why Steve pushed back. I think this is Ron speaking, if I may, Chair. I think that you've said it a couple of times. We need that. We need Steve or or someone from the IP constituency to come back to us and tell us what are those material issues, because we're operating in a vacuum right now.
Yeah, why don't we invite them to a call? Neil, it would be great if Steve or Christina were on this call, right?
Absolutely. Perhaps,
yeah.
Perhaps
maybe
get on the call or give us something clarification on it, because if we could do that next week, that would be helpful.
All right.
This is Aubrey. I'd like to make one comment. I actually think what was recommended there was really quite good, including the having the other House vote on it. The one issue I had was that the prohibition against or the absolute requirement for recusal comes a little late at that point. And it seems to me that it should be required that someone that's going to be in this thing, they know much way early. I mean, they know early if this thing comes to a vote, they will have material, so that they should have had to declare their recusal, you know, weeks before it hits a vote. And so... If somehow, but I like the fact that the notion that it might happen that there is a required conflict of interest that does require an abstention, and that there is a policy allow or practice that allows that to be dealt with, but that it's murderously difficult to get, and you got to pay a price for it. So I actually think it was a good suggestion.
Just to clarify my comment, this is Ron. I wasn't saying it was a poor one. I agree with what you've just said, Avery. I'm just saying that we continue bouncing up against this hypothetical thing that's not defined, and until we get there, we will always have that lack of information will always leave a black hole here for us to try to figure out.
Well, okay, so next steps, should we, we're actually on a biweekly schedule now as a work team. Do we want to set up a special meeting next week to invite Steve and Christina to the call?
I would support that if possible, Chair, because the following week I'm going to actually be on the move on the Wednesday, the 25th. I'll be in transit.
Okay. Do we pretty much agree as a work team that in the case of a material conflict of interest, altering the denominator is appropriate?
Yeah.
I think we do. So yeah. And that is a little bit of a change from our initial position, where we did not want to alter the denominator. So we are now, you know, coming around to that point where we think it is could be appropriate. And really, what we're trying to understand now is what is a material conflict of interest, and is it at the council level, or can it be resolved at the stakeholder group level? And then Ken's idea of, you know, should we? It's not really our call. I mean, each stakeholder. Well, I don't know. Here's some clarification. Rob, you're on the call. You know, if a stakeholder group decides on their own that they want to allow one of their reps to pass their vote on to another rep due to a conflict of interest, can they do that now? If they on their own in their own charter. Or is that disallowed in the bylaws? I believe it's disallowed, isn't it?
I don't think it's specifically permitted. That's a weaselly way to answer. This is Rob.
Yeah, I hear you.
But I think Aubrey makes a very good point, which is procedurally you'd like to be able to capture this far before you ever get to the vote. And so that may be something that the work team wants to consider. Sort of how do you identify these as early as possible so that they can be resolved before your counting quorum and then counting votes?
Okay.
This is Ken. I'm sorry. The reason I introduced that notion of proxy voting is I believe that I've read or inferred something, like maybe Rob saying that proxy voting is not permitted. and I don't have a source to quote, but I know in discussing this with Liz at one point, I think she was pretty sure that if proxy voting was going to be introduced in the council at all, it would have to be entered into the GNSO council procedures.
Yes. A bit of history. There used to be proxy voting, but the legal counsel said that's a no-no without something specific in the bylaws, and nobody ever succeeded in writing anything that they were willing to approve of. So proxy voting, which had been a practice several years ago, was done away with at the instructions of legal counsel.
Right. So in this case, you know, in that Section 5 that I was reading from, if we ended up sort of liking the general tone of that, we could add another bullet which said there's yet a third way to remove a conflict of interest, and that would be to allow proxy voting in a limited and very constrained case, which is what we're talking about. And in that situation, either the NCA from the House or another counselor from that stakeholder group, something like that, would be permitted to enter a vote in a case of a material conflict of interest that was approved, right? So, Ray, we get to the point, and I like the way Robbery said this, it becomes murderously difficult to change the denominator. I mean, it's like, you know, there are so many ways to avoid the conflict that it seems almost impossible that you'd ever end up changing the denominator.
Yeah, and then those rare exceptions where it is necessary, it's the right thing to do. You know, so there's two sides to that as well. It's not that we just don't want the denominator ever to be changed. It's also the fact that, okay, if all the requirements are met, well, it is the right thing to do. So in number five, so we're looking at Section 5 here, right? And you just mentioned adding a bullet point, right, Ken?
I did, and it would go in the second bullet. Seek all reasonable means to eliminate the conflict.
I see it. It would go down there. So you have three down there.
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's my suggestion. I copy Section 5 out, send it to, well, first of all, we're going to invite Steve and Christina to a call next Wednesday. I have to check my schedule, see if I can do that. I will. Anyway, a call next Wednesday, cut and paste this out. This is the topic of discussion. Can they please join the call to provide their perspective? But I need that third bullet point put in there.
And if they can't join the call for some reason, then perhaps they could just send us something in writing that we can all chew on before we get on the call.
Yeah, that would be good. I really would like a discussion on this, though. Really
understood.
Wanna,
understood.
Yeah, I know you do, too.
If there's conflicts, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So is that a good course of action? Julie, can you add that third bullet point in?
I'm sorry.
This is Ken. Why don't I add it, and I'll shoot that
please
to Julie.
Do that. But to be clear, Ray, I would suggest that you are Steve and Christina?
Christina, yeah. Rosette, yeah.
That Ray, that you would send the invite to Steve and Christina.
Oh, yeah. I'm gonna reach out to them. I'll call Steve. I'll reach out to them best I can. Yeah.
Not from staff. Right.
Right, right, right.
Okay, and Ken, you're going to take that bullet point and send that over to Ray, right?
Yep, I'm fashioning it now.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody have any further comments on this? All right, pretty good discussion, I think. Plan of action. So we're doing pretty good. Okay.
Hey, Ray.
Yeah, who's that?
I'm sorry, this is Rob with one other question, and that is, if I recall correctly, the resolution the council passed in Seoul set a time frame 25 November for the work team to provide some further feedback. Just a quick temperature check right now, whether you think you're going to meet that based on this discussion or whether you want to start sending signals that you need additional time.
We're going to need additional time. We're definitely going to need additional time. Two reasons. One, we need to gather this input. Two, there's a holiday in the U.S. coming up at the end of the month. It's going to cause a distraction. So I would like to request another couple of weeks for our work team. Anybody
just
disagree?
No, I think you're right. This is Aubrey. I just wanted to let you know I won't make the meeting next week.
Okay. Is there another day next week? Well, we don't have to do Wednesday.
No, I'm running the IGF meeting that week, and And so there's probably no day that week other than Friday when I'm back home that I'd be able to participate in something.
All right. Well, okay. Well, let me just get the invite out there, and maybe we do this the following week. Even if we have a call on Monday and then another one on Wednesday.
My not being there doesn't matter. I can listen to the recording, So I was just letting you know that I wouldn't make it. I don't think that that's a reason for you not to hold it or to change the schedule.
Understood. Ron, are you not available at all the following week, Ron?
The week of the 23rd. Through the 27th, I'm going to be attending a conference and traveling to and from that conference, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just one voice, and as Aubrey said, I can pick up transcripts and I can participate in that way. And in any case, if we get those folks on the phone, that's one thing. But if it's in written form, that's also easier for us to deal with. But I think let's go forward with the way you're suggesting, Chair, and see how it falls, and then whichever way it works is fine.
Okay, I'll follow up with what obviously we got to accommodate their schedules as well. So
right.
they might have suggestions, and I'll just forward back what I can.
Okay, wait. Both speaking, so I'm sorry, I have to leave right now. So did we fix them for next week, or you are just organizing?
Okay, I'm getting a little bit of breakup on the conference call. Was your question, are we going to have the call next week?
Yes. Okay.
I'm going to plan on it. Yeah, I'm going to contact. Right now, it's Steve and Christina, unless people have other suggestions as well. I'm going to ask for next Wednesday at 1700 UTC and also offer if they have other times that meet their schedules to let us know as well. See what we can do.
Sorry, I have to leave, so I'm very sorry.
Yeah. No, that's okay.
Okay, well then. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Okay. Any other comments or anything? Any other business? Gisela, yes. Yes,
quick
Gisela.
Question. I'll hold a slot for you next week at 1700 UTC, no problem. Should we go ahead with the call next week?
Yeah.
Would you then resume to bi-weekly having a call the following week and then on the 2nd of December, or actually 2 weeks from the 18th?
I think we'll call next week a special meeting and keep the bi-weekly on the schedule we're on now. Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah.
It's just if I have it up on the GNSO calendar, then it gives people a little bit of time to plan.
And I'm thinking now in my head, too, the way I'm going to approach Steve and Christina is that, look, we're reaching out to you as a work team. We're going to hold a special meeting next Wednesday. We're looking for you to attend. This is the time, rather than keeping it open-ended.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm just thinking in my head that might be a better strategy.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. I don't have any other business, and if there are no objections, I think we can adjourn the call and stop the recording.
Perfect.
Thank you. Good night.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ken, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Everyone.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you, Louise.